Hi, I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, host of the Above Average Intelligence podcast here on the DSR Network. Every Monday, I speak with journalists, authors, and of course, actual former intelligence officers, spies like myself, for a look at current events from the perspective of the intelligence community. If that sounds good to you, then please consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Members of the DSR Network gain access to exclusive content, access to the DSR Slack and Discord communities, expanded show notes for select episodes, and more. All of this for just $7 a month or $70 for a year. As a thank you for listening, I'm offering 25% off the regular membership price. Please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code Intel. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code Intel.
This is Above Average Intelligence, a production of the DSR Network. Each week, hosts Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf are joined by leading experts from the intelligence community for expert analysis on the biggest security challenges around the world.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, and this is DSR's Above Average Intelligence Show. Today, I'm very happy to welcome as my guest, Adam Gamal. This is actually a particular great thrill for me because Adam and I had worked together many years ago, but Adam actually is a pseudonym created to keep himself and his family safe from harm. Adam served in the most elite units in the U.S. Army, deployed more than a dozen times, and finally retired in 2016. His awards include the Bronze Star Medal, the Purple Heart, and the Legion of Merit. Currently, he's an international consultant for a security organization, and most importantly, he's the author of this book that I have in my hand here, The Unit, My Life Fighting Terrorists as One of America's Most Secret Military Operatives. Adam, it is a thrill for you to join us today. It's a great honor. Again, we work together, but I'll tell you, we're going to talk a lot about some current events, about the book, about your career, but I would say the book is more kind of a story about America and the American dream, and it was inspirational. I loved it. I was riveted. So congratulations on the book. And again, welcome to the show.
Mark, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. Since we worked together before, that was like a while back. I always tried to pronounce your last name and I was waiting for you to say it now. And I'm like, let me see if I can pick it, but I still couldn't. I'm an idiot. But thank you for having me.
That's great. So one of the cool things about Adam and I, and you know, we have to be careful because we did work for several months together in an undisclosed location, which was, you know, for lack of, it was a dangerous place. It was an exciting place. I dare say we had some fun there as well, kind of doing great things for the U.S. government. But one of the cool things when I first met you, Adam, was I realized we had something in common, and that is Alexandria, Egypt.
Correct. I still remember that. Was it your grandfather or your father was born there?
My grandmother. So my grandmother was one of these, and if you obviously, and you can tell your story a bit, but if you remember from Alex, that's what, you know, we called it. I don't know if you call that as well, but from Alex is that, you know, the Greeks there, and the street signs in Alexandria were in Greek. So she was one of the Greeks who kind of grew up there and told incredible stories of the Corniche and really an incredible life there. And then they lost all their money and they had to, then they moved to Greece. But I remember when I went back there years later when I was serving in Cairo, I actually had Egyptian intelligence try to track down the old house, and it was gone. The governor of the area, whoever was responsible for Alexandria, was actually a former Egyptian intelligence officer, and so he helped me. But we couldn't find the house. But again, it's, you know, the Alex Greeks are pretty prominent, and that's why I think you and I bonded right off the bat.
Yeah, and I did mention that a lot in the book, as growing up in Alexandria was very unique because you have the Greeks honestly were the most expats were living there, were the Greeks. Where I lived exactly, we had a Greek church was right across the street. We had like an elderly home, a Greek. There is a Greek club was like one train station away from me. I play basketball, as I mentioned that in the book, although I'm short. So there was two Greek clubs, sports clubs. If I pronounce their names, you laugh at me, so I'm not going to say their names. But they did exist in Alexandria till recently. I'm not sure if they still exist there or not, but there was a huge Greek population. And yes, we did click the first day. We both don't have hair.
I see. And one of the other cool things that I remember sitting around in Cairo having a Stella beer. Remember Stella?
Stella, yes.
And it turns out my great grandfather was one of, but he was one of the investors when the original investors in it. And so just, yeah, some really neat kind of, you know, memories there and something that you and I bonded on. The other thing I think we can, well, you can tell the story as you like. I don't want to get you in trouble, but you and I had a particularly interesting situation on the roof of a U.S. facility. And I think I remember I was hiding behind you and I was trying not to get shot at. And I was thinking, I found the one special operations operator who's shorter than me.
Yeah, I was like, you know, some people tried to hide behind me and I'm like, dude, this is not going to help you. There is still like in the side and in the top. But so the story was cleared without mentioning the location. But yes, I do remember very well. It is in the book. So I do remember very well the explosion, the grenade that didn't explode. One of the other special operation guys like disarmed it and threw it at the RSO, and the RSO freaked out, was about to shit in his pants. I'm sure you're still in touch with the other special operation guy as well. That's what I hear.
I am. I just talked to him the other day.
Yeah. So it's a very small world, very small community, and I'm glad we stayed in touch.
Absolutely, and I'll say in that incident, you know, and I talk about it openly. We can't talk about it now, but I've talked about it openly, and I will say that you and your team saved our butt that day, no doubt about it. One of those incredible moments where, you know, there's and you know, I think it, towards the end of the show we'll talk about kind of the history and the future of the CIA Special Operations, the SOF relationship, and you know where that goes. But I'll tell you, you know, when you kind of, you know, spend a lot of time together, you develop these personal relationships. And so there's kind of institutional biases. Sometimes there's institutional conflicts when it comes to stuff like that on the ground. I think that we work really well together. And then when you go through these kind of, you know, incidents where you're not sure you're going to make it out of there. I mean, when that incident occurred, I wasn't sure we were going to all go home that day. But the fact that when you all stepped in, and, you know, I do give you credit, I was crouching behind you. So. Thank you. My wife thanks you too, and she says hello.
Thank you, and she's awesome. I remember her very well. We all connected very well. But yeah, absolutely right, Mark. What some people don't realize, people think war is only in war zones, but you get through a lot of those experiences in non-war zones. I mean, as a matter of fact, non-war zones to me were more dangerous than war zones. War zones, you are moving around in uniform with big big trucks, big tanks. You have air support. You have all the military might support behind you. Where in the location where you and I were serving at, I would say other than the Marine guards, the embassy had like four or five other military people, no weapons other than the few firearms that we had there that not a lot of people knew about. But if a big group of people decided to take over the embassy, they can, which it happened. I mean, like, that was the original creation of the organization was based on what happened in Iran and with the Iran hostage situation. So a lot of people don't give enough credit to people serving in non-combat zones, but I believe they are more dangerous than the other combat zones.
Agreed. And a lot of time you also get, you let your guard down as well. You know, as you're walking the streets, I mean, you're taking your kids to school, going off to the embassy, and the embassy gets attacked. But before we jump into the book and your career, because I really do want to jump into this, because I think we have some similarities. I was born in Greece, as we mentioned. My wife, she was born in Lebanon. You were born in Egypt. I mean, I think there's a lot of kind of immigrant success stories in the intelligence community and special operations world. But hold that thought for just a second, because I do want to jump in on some current events, how we usually start the shows, and that's the recent terrorist attacks from ISIS-K in Moscow. And just, you know, thinking back, you know, where we are right now, you know, a country that where in essence the aircraft carrier has kind of turned to great power competition to China, Russia. The whole defense enterprise certainly has. I'm sure the special operations world, same thing with the CIA. But sometimes, you know, terrorist events come back and remind you that there's still a need for kind of an aggressive and a robust counterterrorism policy and a robust counterterrorism capability. What are your thoughts on what happened in Moscow and kind of the threat posed by terrorism? And if we're actually, the U.S. government is poised to be able to deal with this now.
So it's a very interesting topic. And for some reason, for the last few years, I mean, the U.S. government seems like they declared the war on terrorism ended. But if you look at, and a lot of people are trying to analyze why ISIS-K went after Moscow. But what people don't realize what the Russians have been doing in Syria, bombing ISIS in cooperation with the U.S. So if this tells us anything, the ISIS have a very long memory. They're not going to forget. They did not forget. They found a way to penetrate Russia, which is police state, security everywhere. They were able to penetrate that. And again, that's because what the Russian military was doing in Syria. Well, we are doing similar things in Syria. We've done in Iraq. We've done in Somalia. We're doing in Somalia. We're doing all over. So if that teaches us something, it teaches us that ISIS might still be trying, and I guarantee you, they are trying to find a target of opportunity or find a soft target or even a hard target if they can make it to the U.S. With everything else going in current events as well, they can find a lot of sympathizers. We brought a lot of people from Afghanistan. Most likely 99.9% of them are good people, but that might be one or two guys just snuck through that might be able to do something. So we have to stay vigilant. We have to stay on top of the game. And I don't believe the war on terrorism ended.
You know, General Kurilla, the head of Central Command, even said, I think in congressional testimony a couple of weeks ago, that he thought ISIS-K was the biggest threat to U.S. interests in Europe. And so, you know, when you think about, Moscow, an attack in Moscow, is why would that be any different than some kind of attempt in Paris or Berlin? So I think that certainly is a concern. And so, but of course, we don't have those kind of, ISIS-K with the base in Afghanistan, we don't have boots on the ground there. We don't have intelligence resources there. We certainly don't have the ISR there. Is that something that, is Afghanistan kind of returning as an ungoverned, lawless space? Is that of concern to you when in terms of the ability of the U.S. to monitor, the activities of ISIS-K?
Yeah, in my opinion, yes. It's you have what's going on between Afghanistan and Pakistan. You have China is budding in Afghanistan. They doing things there as well. So you have even like the Taliban now trying to show their good side. They're trying to govern. They're trying to do a lot of things. And I'm sure I'm not in the service, but I'm assuming there is communication. I guarantee you there is communication directly or indirectly between the Taliban and the U.S. government. They've been communicating directly for a long time. It's no secret. But the Taliban, if they have, it's a very hard thing for them to balance. The balance between the Haqqani network, the ISIS-K, all the sympathizers, all the people who helped them during the war against us. And now they're not going to turn around 180 degrees and be against them. You'll find people from within the Taliban most likely supporting ISIS-K, whether, again, directly or indirectly. So when you put all of those things together and our lack of presence on the ground there, our lack of interest there, that we pulled out in a very shameful way, the way how we left. So there, and like you said earlier, attacking somewhere in Moscow most likely would be harder than attacking I don't want to give ideas, but like, we have embassies all over Europe. There is like a lot of foreign populations in Denmark, for example. Huge, I'm not going to name nationalities so people don't think I'm being I have a phobia from anybody because I don't, but there are countries in Europe where there are population from certain countries in the Middle East where those people can easily have an attack.
Look, I think I'm sure that kind of the liaison relationships we have in Europe are going into overdrive now, exactly for this reason, that we have to have, extensive surveillance and monitoring. But one thing I just, I spent a long time in Afghanistan. I was, as a base chief there for a year, 2011 to 2012. And in essence, directly fighting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And the notion that, and I'm just, I don't know if this is the case, but again, just like you, Adam, I imagine putting a tear line together that says secret release Taliban with information on kind of our joint enemy, ISIS-K, that still kind of bothers me because I don't trust the Taliban. You know, they still harbor Al-Qaeda, and I think you're right. They're probably infiltrated by ISIS. But, you know, the idea of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, at some point, I think having kind of a counterterrorism relationship with the Taliban, if that is what is going to keep us safe, I don't know. I'm a little skeptical.
Let me draw a parallel there for you and for the listeners. So forget the Taliban. Let's look at the Pakistani government. Let's look at the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service. They were semi-allies during the war on terrorism. We used to give them terror lines, and they used to tip. The guys were going to detain, and the guys will disappear. So the success for killing bin Laden was because we did not tell the Pakistanis anything. So imagine that, and that was the Pakistani government, which we given them weapons, we given them, and they were a legit government. Now the Taliban, we still didn't recognize them as a government. We had issues with them for a long time. I'm sure, like I said, I'm sure there are discussions going back and forth. But when you put those things together and you give the Taliban a terror line, again, if you put this in parallel with what the Pakistanis were doing, so you still, I don't think you hedge in your bet in the right direction, 100% still.
That's right. I agree. And that's I think your the analogy to Pakistan is a perfect one. I mean, my God, I was along the border for a year, and we would watch Al-Qaeda and the Taliban come into Pakistani military positions with Pakistani military there and fire 107 millimeter rockets at us. So that's certainly not something to sleep well at night, considering ISIS-K. And I think that, you know, ultimately, I think you're right. I was never in favor of a full withdrawal from Afghanistan. I thought leaving kind of my old crew there and your old crew would have been smart. But here we are. Let's switch to the book for a second. Again, the unit. You mentioned it in the book, but it really is a story about the American dream. I absolutely loved it. And again, I think a lot of people could also identify with it. So I guess the first question for you, Adam, is, you know, why'd you write it? What was the goal?
So it's, I got asked that question a few times, and every time I tell people, like, you know, why wouldn't I write it? But the best answer is, like, big part of it, and this is the truth from going through the process, going through, like, you know, thinking about what I should do, what I shouldn't do, what I should write, what I shouldn't write. But there is a part of Shadow Warriors that a lot of people don't know anything about. So I wanted to highlight, you know, what these guys doing, and to give people some peace of mind. Like, there are people actually taking their fight to the enemy. But at the same time, I remember actually the location where you and I served. The day I landed, I had somebody from the embassy coming to pick me up with a sign, and he had my name on it, waiting for me at the airport. So I walk to the guy, and he's looking at me like, "What do you want?" So I look at him and I'm like, "By the way, that's me. Like, you holding a sign with my name on it." He did not think like an Arab American, 5'1", can be a joint special operation guy doing those things. So I wanted to send the message to everybody, like, you know, not every special operation guy, not every Marine, not every soldier who just looks like Tom Hanks. We have people who come in every color and shape. So that's the message I wanted to send to people, and to show the value of people like you and I and your wife and other people. And my wife was in similar services. We actually bring a lot to the table. And if we start discounting immigrants, the sons of immigrants, we're losing out. So that's a big part of what I wanted to show. And you know what? I know I'm biased because it was my story. I thought it was a cool story. A kid came from Egypt with no money, no English, nothing. And I wanted to show everybody, you don't have excuses. I mean, don't. If you have the grit and the determination and the will to succeed, you will succeed. And I made it to the highest enlisted rank in the U.S. military.
One of the things that I was impressed with is that, and I certainly, if you follow my Twitter feed, I have not been successful at this, but you made this apolitical, which I think is really important. And because, you know, and so, you know, what you're saying is, you know, in the notes I took, I wrote immigrant families rock. You know, I mean, it's just, but it's an immigrant success story, but it's also a story of incredibly hard work. And the last piece on that, though, which I think, and again, the book is apolitical, but there's a powerful point to be made about diversity. And let me just say that, you know, when I talk about diversity and you say that in any speech and people start going crazy and you just tell everyone stop. And so what this is what diversity means. And by the way, this is Adam. This is exactly you. Is if I'm running a intelligence unit or special operations unit, I want people who are not going to get caught, simply. So, you know, for example, you know, one of the secrets of CIA, it's not a secret, and I've had this cleared, is, you know, across the globe, some of our most sensitive cases are handled by female case officers. Well, why is that? Well, especially in the Arab world, you put in a buy on. So you're just not going to get caught. Simple as that. Or maybe the host country intelligence service is so misogynistic, they don't believe, you know, X, Y, and Z could be an intelligence officer. And so, you know, I would always say, look, the best athlete approach might be, we're not going to take the white dude and put him on the streets of Khartoum. Sorry, but America is this incredibly diverse place. And if I can have a diverse officer pool, I'm going to put people out in the street. It's clandestine works, you know, who are not going to get caught. And I think that's some of the power of your book as well. What are your thoughts on that?
So Mark, when I tell people, like, you know, diversity is our strength, people take it as, again, they make it very political. They like, and there is nothing political about my book. People said, why you didn't criticize the Biden administration for pulling out of Afghanistan the way how they pulled out of Afghanistan? If I can answer them, I would have answered them, because I'm like, by the way, my book was in DOD for review since like August, July, years. August of 2021. So when the Taliban were like taking over Afghanistan, my book was still in DOD. So I couldn't change anything. But that's not the point. I want to go back to actually our mission together. I remember very well, there was like a lot of places were off limit. There was a lot of things that we could not send an embassy person to certain areas in town to buy. I don't want to get into sources and methods, but to buy certain things that can be mission enablers, right? I was able to go to those places because I spoke native language. I hung out with them. So unless I'm walking around with a stamp on my forehead saying U.S. diplomat, nobody knew. And I would go through doing the due diligence to make sure that I'm not followed, and go to certain areas that, so without those diversity, you could not accomplish those missions. Again, it could be an enabler, it could be a deterrent, it could be that you're stopping terrorist acts from happening, you're stopping the flood of foreign fighters going to Iraq to attack American soldiers. So, but when I say diversity, I'm talking about having, you cannot eat, you might love sushi, but you cannot eat sushi every day. If you eat sushi every day, you'll get sick one day. You have to change what you do, and we have to change.
That's right, I like that.
And we are extremely lucky as a country that we have the, and people don't like, we have the Greek Americans, we have the Arab Americans, we have the Latin Americans, we have African Americans, we have European Americans. And people say, well, you should say American first. Well, guys, if they are Americans, they are Americans. We're just trying to emphasize the benefit we get from having that. A lot of countries don't have that. They don't have the same opportunity. They don't have the same benefit. Because if I'm in Japan, I cannot go to some of the locations I went to as a Japanese and walk around the corner and just buy tomatoes. Again, diversity here, we're not talking about diversity with unskilled people. No, we're talking about not lowering the standard, keeping the standard the same, but opening the field to everybody. Like, you cannot come to the U.S. and take the keys to Ellis Island and say, nobody else can come after me.
I mean, diversity in some ways in our old world can be, you know, part of our superpowers. I mean, I really believe that. And I think when the way what you certainly talk about and insinuates in the book, that helps that argument. And I think, and actually, while it's apolitical, I think it does help maybe tone down some of the kind of the vitriol in this kind of stuff.
I hope so. I hope people can just understand and read what's meant by that message. And diversity is not a bad word. I mean, since when us as a U.S., as America, we can go and say diversity is bad? That boggles my mind.
Let me ask one quick question. I was, you know, I was giving a talk the other day at George Washington University, and one of the students asked me a question. I was actually, you know me, I'm chatty, and I was actually stumped on this. And he said, you know, what makes someone like you or someone from the special operations world kind of, you know, how do you do it? How does, and when I say this, I'm not one who kind of ran into danger. You know, sometimes it found me, but you know, how do you train yourself, or is it, what's in the kind of your makeup that, you know, has you volunteering for kind of, you know, conflict zone assignments or makes you run into the fire? And, you know, I gave a really bad answer. I was thinking about it afterwards, and I was like, you know, I don't know if there's an answer to that. And of course, reading your book, it talks about, you know, kind of the unique nature of your unit. But thinking back to you and some of your teammates, and I know many of them, what was special about that? That, you know, conflict happens, boom, you guys are deployed, gals are deployed. That's an important point too, because you had some incredible female operatives. But what is the inner strength that you have to be like, you know, Iraq's kicking off, I'm going. You talk about, hey, you wanted to go to Africa, dangerous place, Afghanistan. What's that inside of you that kind of can drive you? What makes you different?
I think I wouldn't say we are different. I would just say that we look at the situation maybe differently. You have to have a purpose, and we put mission and country first. And then that the psychological evaluations, I guess the psych does to select the right people. Part of it is you go in, the part of our selection process is they want to see if you are willing to go to the unknown. You like when I was said in, like I said, selection is not classified, but for the integrity, I don't talk about it a lot. But one of the things is like when they tell you run, they don't tell you for how long you're running. They just say, hey, run. And then you run. And mentally, you are, I think, wired in a way like, I'm just going to keep running till either I drop dead or they tell me stop. And then the run ends when actually somebody comes out of nowhere that you don't know where he came from, and he's like, you're done. So I think we are wired in a way that to have faith, enough faith, and here what I mean by faith is not from a spiritual faith. I mean faith in yourself, in your energy, in your power. But again, the biggest thing I think like putting something above your own self, which is the selfless service. So I think that's what made all of us wanted to, yeah, I want to go to Afghanistan. I know there is a war there. You know what? I'm going to go walk through the door first, not knowing what's behind the door.
I remember I was, you know, and it was, I'm trying to think, we did have one of your teammates up in Northern Iraq. This is late 2002. And we'd gone up to live with the Kurds. And I remember clearly, we got up there and some of us were scratching our heads and we said, you know, I don't know if we have an exfil plan because, you know, Interlik couldn't reach us. They didn't have enough helos to get us. And someone said, well, screw it. Hey, we'll just walk into Iran and tell them who we are. And everyone's like, yeah, that sounds good. And I always laugh at that because that's the kind of mentality that a lot of us had. And certainly that your unit had as well is you know, you're going to get the job done and there's going to be, you know, you're going to improvise along the way. I think that's probably part of the selection process that you all go through as well on that. Let me ask you. The last piece about a book, and again, it's something that I absolutely highly recommend. I loved it. It's a great read. It's inspirational. It made me laugh, gave me some tears here and there. Obviously, I'm biased, but when you do something like this, there's also not a negative part of it, but it's got to be in the back of your mind. Okay, what's the reaction going to be like from, you know, members of the unit? How has that been? Is that something that concerns you in writing what I think is the first book about your old organization, in fact?
Yeah, so it's the first book is written by an actual operative. There are other books have been written by guys, journalists sitting in a bar, having sources, getting information here and there. That's why, honestly, it took us over 3 years. So between Kelly, my co-author, myself, and going through the process, having Mark Zaid as a lawyer to represent us, taking it through DOD. To answer your question, did I have concerns? Absolutely. People usually cast their judgment before they know the facts. So before the book came out, and there was some publicity about the book, so I got messages, indirect messages from people saying, why did you do that? This is not right. And everybody was like, you know what? you know, Adam just spilled the beans. He went out and he just put that, sold the unit out. And I was like, my answer to everybody was like, okay, it went through the process. It sat in DoD for over a year. I sat with DoD, went over page by page, picture by picture. Even the pictures in the book have been cleared by DoD. So we went over all the process. I said, just let's wait till the book comes out. The book is more of an inspirational story. Hopefully will give people hope. But did I get any like negative feedback? Honestly, 95% of the guys from the community reached out to me. Some people have not talked to me for 10 years. Reached out to me with very encouraging messages, were very supportive, and they were like, we heard your voice as we read in the book. Thank you for doing this. And we know you did not do it for fame or money, which is clear. I'm not going with my true name. And a good chunk of the proceeds from the book going to veterans organization. We donated some already. Even before we got the money, we donated some to veterans organizations. And we are in discussion with an organization that supports education for immigrants. That we are in discussion with them already about to see how we can support them.
Amazing. You know, I think one of the things that you, first of all, there's two parts of it. You know, as I kind of talked to people in and around your community, I actually asked them and they said, those who read the book said it was awesome. So it's simple as that. You got to read it. So it's because it's a book about the American dream. It's not a tell all. You know, there's nothing spilled about, operations. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I found, obviously with, you know, my role as a former agency officer and a lot of stuff I do and I write in the media is you have to, and this, it's hard because you do care about, you know, your colleagues from the past, but you have to almost kind of remove yourself and say, I don't really care what they're going to say. It's hard to do that. But you say to yourself, I went through the review process. I'm not spilling the beans. You know, there's always this kind of mantra, do no harm. And you certainly lived up to that. And so at some point you kind of just got to let it go and say, you know what, if they don't like me for this, there's nothing I can do about it. You know yourself, you know, the book, people who've read the book will have a different view. I would probably say any naysayers, anyone who's going to condemn you, has not read.
And you know what, Mark, I said this to a few people as I was going through the process. I said, you know, there are people who love you and no matter what you do, you can go out and shoot their dog. And they'd be like, you know what? Mark had a bad day, man. He was stressed. You know, let's figure out what was wrong with him. And then there are people who hate you. And you can give him a cup of tea. And they'd be like, that mofo gave me a hot cup of tea to burn my tongue. And if it wasn't hot, they'd be like, it was cold. It didn't taste good. So if you, Abraham Lincoln said, if he was going to read, what critics saying about him, he wouldn't have enough time to govern. So you're absolutely right. You get to the point where you have a higher message that you're trying to deliver. You have something more important than pleasing people. But if you want people to love you, go sell ice cream and people will love you. Somebody will criticize you still. But I'm beyond that. Thank you.
So this is the point in the podcast where we have to say goodbye to our guests who are not yet subscribers. If you want to listen to the rest of the podcast and to all of the other shows in full, just go to the dsrnetwork.com and click on membership. It's only $7 a month and it brings you a lot of great bonus content. So if you're not a subscriber, we hope you will be soon. And if you are one, stand by. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to Above Average Intelligence, hosted every week by Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf. Above Average Intelligence is a production of the DSR Network and was produced by Riley Fessler.